Iowa schools face tough decisions as the legislature considers changes in the classroom and funding that some say is not nearly enough to educate our children in the cities. Lawmakers in Des Moines and Springfield are wrestling over the biggest issue they face every session, the state budget. And education funding is always a major portion of that plan. In Illinois, the governor is calling for a $305 million increase in what's called evidence-based funding. The state spends more than $9 billion of its budget on K-12 education. And in Iowa, lawmakers are looking to increase education funding by about 2% over what it's spent this year. That's roughly $4 billion that it's spent. Iowa lawmakers are also considering a host of new regulations, including looser vaccination requirements. So we decided to talk with Bettendorf School Superintendent Dr. Michelle Morris about these issues and others in the classroom. We have reached that point in the second semester where we're at spring break right now in Bettendorf. It really is a nice break time for students as they head into the very last few months of school. Can you tell me a little bit of what it's like in the schools right now when kids are getting that close to summertime?
You know, with any student, as it gets closer and closer to that summer break, you know, excitement builds. You start to see a little bit of fatigue, I think, at times of, I still have 8 more weeks, 10 more weeks of school, but overall things are going really well this year, and the school year is, we're finding great success and our students are doing great. So,
and I always wonder, because you have that drop off during the summer where kids may not remember all the stuff they learned in the school year before, that type of ramping back up for students, I mean, you're thinking about that right now for the next school year. Is that still a concern on how best to make sure the students are able to keep what they learned this semester going into the next semester?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, ironically, we've started planning for the next school year way back in December, before the holidays, and are in full-fledged of finishing out the current school year while getting next school year ready to go. Mm-hmm. In terms of summer loss, I think from our elementary perspective, we've done quite a bit of work around that and in terms of getting kids prepared and ensuring mastery of concepts before they leave us for summer break. We're starting to actually see in our fall assessments that students take, kind of some benchmark assessments when they return from summer, we're seeing some really good, solid holding on to what they learned the previous year.
That's a big deal. A lot less slide
than maybe what had been seen. It is absolutely a big deal.
What do you attribute that to?
I just think we've been very intentional about aligning curriculum in terms of our 5 elementary buildings to ensure all students have access to the same high quality and rigorous curriculum, high quality tier 1 instruction, as well as interventions. So for those students that might need a little bit more, as we call it, tier 1 plus more, tier 2 or tier 3 interventions, I think it's just those adjustments we've made based on research and what we know is best for kids is helping us help students hold on to that learning.
And that's a lot of what's being done in these last few weeks of this school year, right? Is to make sure that, as you said, get the basics there, and then you can build upon that next fall.
Correct, yes. And as we come out of spring break, our teachers and students will be getting ready to gear up for the annual state standardized assessments, the ISASP, that is given annually. And then we also have to end the year in K-8 with our third round of what we call benchmark assessments using our FastBridge assessment tool.
Let's talk about these assessments. I know every child is different. Some kids learn and retain. Some kids, it takes longer. Some kids are good at tests. Some kids are not. Mm-hmm. This ongoing assessment of students, which is a lot mandated by the state, but others as well, how difficult is that for kids, but also for teachers and administrators?
You know, I would say any time where your daily instruction is interrupted, it can present challenges, right? Because we have a flow, our routine might be disruptive. But I think when we think of an assessment, I think of it as an opportunity to learn more, right? To learn more about what is that student learning? How are they learning? And how can I better support them based on the data that comes back? And also keeping in mind, with state standardized assessments, this is a snapshot in time. This isn't about my learning, ongoing learning, and that's why there's those more frequent kind of benchmark assessments that we do 3 times a year, and then teachers are doing what they call formative assessments almost on a daily basis, right? Checking to see if the lesson that we just taught, who grasped it, who mastered it, who maybe needs a little bit of reteaching, and who might need some additional intervention to support that learning. I think if we, assessments that have always gotten a bad rap, I don't think they should be the end-all be-all on how we judge performance of a student, of a teacher, or of a district. But if we use it as a tool, one of the many tools we have to help us inform what does that look like for each student that I have in my classroom, then I think from that sense, it is a positive thing that helps guide how we teach students today.
But as you know, with greater choice, we'll say, for parents, they look at that as a report card sometimes. Mm-hmm. And that's got to be somewhat frustrating as an administrator, as, like you said, it's a performance review, it's a snapshot at that moment, and it's a milestone that hopefully gets you to the next milestone. But that really has to be problematic for districts that are now competing for students.
It can have a negative impact. Yes, if I as the consumer are looking at what is the best option for my child, if I'm only focused on that piece of data, then that might deter me from entering a specific public school district, right? But I think we need to look beyond just that assessment data. What are the qualifications of the teacher that's in front of my student? Research will tell you that the greatest determining factor for a student's performance or achievement academically is the quality of the teacher in the classroom. So how well have they been trained? What's their background? What's their licensure, right? The other piece is what does the school have to offer or the district? Sometimes families will realize if they choose other options, charter schools, private schools, that maybe the robustness of the co-curricular and extracurricular activities are not there, right? There might not be all these clubs or sports or fine arts opportunities that we would have in a public setting, which only enrich and enhance mm-hmm. that learning environment, right? Because academics is one piece. Ultimately, what we strive to do in our school district in Bettendorf is to prepare that student holistically for whatever that future looks like for them, right? Some may go to college, some may choose to go straight to the workforce, but how do we create not just an academically well-rounded child, but how do we create someone that will be a positive contributor to society in general, right? So how do we focus on that person's character? How do we help them instill in school study habits that lead to good work habits, to be a good collaborator, a good partner in the workforce? And how do we develop that? And so I think through all those experiences, not just in the classroom, but outside the classroom, that helps us make sure our students are best prepared.
And in order to do that, you have to have, of course, adequate funding. And that takes me to the next point. And I would think budgeting for a school district each year has got to be one of the biggest challenges mm-hmm. that's on your plate. We now know that the state is probably looking at 2% increase, mm-hmm. not the 5% that many people, or Democrats at least, had hoped and a lot of school educators had hoped, but really didn't expect. It was down to a 1.75% increase and went as high as, I think, 2.5%. That 2% benchmark is kind of where we thought we were going to be, because that's kind of what the governor had suggested as well. Where does that put Bettendorf when you look at the cost of living increases and the expenses of teacher contracts and other expenses that the district has? A 2% increase, what does that mean?
Well, for 199 districts in the state of Iowa, that will mean we'll be on budget guarantee and we'll be one of those 199 school districts. So that 2% isn't enough to bridge the difference from an enrollment standpoint. And so historically, that has meant that through budget guarantee, you know, you're guaranteed 101% of your funding for the next school year. But a year after that, you have to then tax back your homeowners in your, or your property owners in your catchment area to make up that difference. Now, there is some legislation and talk moving around that in the various property reform tax bills that are out there, that the governor is saying she does not want districts to be able to do that, and that the state would cover the cost, essentially, of budget guarantee, that deficit cost. There's still so much out there and differences that I can't talk specifically to that. But as we know, inflation has been way higher than 2%. Settlement agreements in the state of Iowa, there's a factor that we use either CPIU of the Midwest or 3%, whichever is lower. So we know that in most situations, districts across the state, as they're working with their associations, their unions, are usually looking at around a 3% increase for salaries, right? And so if you're only getting 2%, even if it is new money, but inflation is running higher than 2%, and you know your salary packages are going to cost, let's just say, average 3%, you know.
It's not sustainable.
It's not sustainable.
So, but it's almost, it's not changing, though. I mean, this has been going on from Des Moines year after year after year. So you're falling further and further behind. And then you add the educational savings accounts, you add charter schools, you add all the competition that public schools are facing. I mean, do you feel that the legislature is almost turning its back on public education?
That's a great question. I would say I'm not opposed to choice. I think parents have to make a very personal decision about what's best for their families. However, when the choices available to families are not on equal playing fields, that presents challenges. So, for example, a family that chooses an education savings account to go to a private school, those private schools don't have to take every student like a public education system does. They don't necessarily have to serve students with individual education plans or students with disabilities. They're not under the same requirements as we are in terms of reporting how their money is being utilized, or they don't have to go through the same assessments and have the same accountability report card, as you mentioned earlier in the conversation, that public schools do. And so I think as superintendents across the state, the one thing I know a very common conversation most of us have had is choice. It's here. It's not going anywhere in the foreseeable future.
Absolutely.
And I'm okay with that. Competition can help all systems be better, right? Just want to make sure it's not at the expense of our students, because they are the core of everything we do. But with that, there should be some equity across expectations. If we're going to have that choice. And if funding is going to be diverted to those systems, then, you know, I think there should be some accountability across all systems.
How do you plan for the future then? I mean, because your budget is going to be a one-year budget, but you must be looking out 5 years from now. You're seeing enrollment trends generally going down over the next 5 years, so that means even less money coming in. You're seeing more moves by the legislature for property tax caps at best, and then you add to that a smaller state funding year by year, expenses going up. How do you plan 5 years out?
Carefully.
Yes,
and very with a
carefully.
Lot of thought and a lot of plans, A, B, C, D, right? There's multiple options in that, and I think how we do it, since I have been blessed to serve in Bettendorf, we've stayed on the more fiscally conservative side in terms of, as a position comes open due to a vacancy, whether someone's retiring, moving out of the area, because, you know, our biggest employers in the area don't necessarily fall on a school district calendar sometimes in terms of employment and when they get relocated, we really evaluate, do we continue to need that position? If so, in its current form, in a different form, what does that look like, right? And so we've done extremely well in Bettendorf to leverage evaluation of each position and through attrition manage enrollment shifts. We've also sought out other sources for funding, such as grant funding. I mean, we've secured over $1 million worth of grants to help us support work around social, emotional, and behavioral health to for both students and staff to help support them in that work so we can defray that cost from the general fund. And we were very lucky to have some of those COVID dollars, as they called them, in the day. And that helped us also offset costs to our general fund.
But that was, of course, short term.
It was. And we used that strategically, not to put it into positions that might be ongoing positions, but what were more one-time expenses. So as we had to update curriculum and intervention resources, we used those dollars to fund those heavy hitters, because curriculum can cost upwards of $500,000 to $1 million for an implementation. So how do we leverage that to save those general fund dollars for more dire times?
But at the same time, somebody might point out, oh, you've got these construction projects. You're flush with cash. You've got the middle school construction that's going on. Of course, that's part of a separate budget because it's more of the sales tax. How important is keeping these, and you just, the elementary school changes that you've had over the last few years. Is that pretty much just keeping up with the times and making sure that students are in modern buildings, or is it something more than that?
Well, when it comes to our facilities, we want to make sure that we have facilities that are safe and flexible to meet the learning needs today, but also to meet those learning needs 5 years from now, 10 years from now. And so Bettendorf, prior to even me arriving, had made choices to invest to ensure those facilities were modern, safe, and flexible. You are right. We are currently engaged in a 5-year phased modernization of our middle school, probably one of our oldest buildings in the district that needed some TLC. And so those saved dollars, so we have two funding sources that have very specific ways we can spend them, PEPL and SAVE. And SAVE is funded through the 1 cent sales tax, and there's some movement through legislation right now where they could, by 2030, transfer back to the state 30% of those dollars we would typically bring in through SAVE revenue back to the state. That could mean millions of dollars for us a year and compromise our ability to keep facilities modernized and up to date. For example, so with the SAVE dollars, there is, when we get approval from the voters to use our SAVE dollars, right, every 10 years, those are not an increase in taxes. That's that discretionary 1 cent sales tax. If I can choose to go buy, I don't know, a coffee mug that costs $10, or I can choose to buy one that costs $3, I'm going to pay less sales tax on the lower priced item. And so those dollars have been instrumental. It's how Mark Twain and Grant Wood were rebuilt, and it is how we are funding the $34 million middle school renovation. And without those dollars and that ability to bond against that revenue source, I don't know. It'll be very challenging for districts. Some districts also use those saved dollars for transportation, for technology infrastructure. There's a bill currently coming out of committee that could require putting additional cameras in classrooms, in special education classrooms. Well, there's an initial cost for that equipment, but there's ongoing costs. There's server costs to maintain that footage, to even operate those systems, and we can use our PEPL and SAVE dollars to help fund those. So without that, I don't know, without additional money, how we would meet that mandate, right, that legislative mandate.
Speaking of legislature, and we just have a few more moments left, there's some things that went through the funnel system. As you well know, the Iowa legislature does that, the funnel being bills, tons of bills introduced off the top. What makes it through the funnel could end up being a law down the road. One of them is Iowa students would no longer have to be vaccinated for diseases like diphtheria, whooping cough, tetanus, polio, measles, rubella, chickenpox before attending a school, according to a House bill. Is that somewhat concerning for a school administrator who has a number of children that are all in one location?
I don't know how it wouldn't be. I mean, we're seeing news reports just over the last week about measles outbreaks. I think it was South Carolina that had the highest incidence of measles in decades, right? Anytime, I do want to clarify, vaccinations is, a very personal decision by families. But I do think we have seen decades of success with vaccinations to eradicate diseases that can cause death or even permanent disabilities, right? And so when you have large numbers of children that aren't vaccinated, you can see big outbreaks, right? You alluded to it very appropriately. In a school classroom where there's lots of germs shared, right? Mm-hmm. What that can do then is disrupt the learning process for students, right? So if one becomes sick with measles or whatever the illness is, and it starts to spread, you could be down 50% of your students, 75. Well, when we're not at school, we know we lose learning, right? We don't have the best way to learn is to be present and in school and be in attendance. And so from an administrator standpoint, just that worry that could we potentially lose a student because of changes in vaccine laws? How much learning are we going to lose that we are being measured by? And so, you know, I want our students to be healthy so they're ready to access their learning and have fun in school.
Once again, these are bills that are in the legislature, mm-hmm. so we have to wait. And then whether the governor vetoes it or approves it, we still have to wait for that as well.
Correct.
But thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. Always great to be with you. I appreciate the time.
Our thanks to Bettendorf School Superintendent Dr. Michelle Morris. We're gearing up for a great St. Patrick's Day weekend, running into Tuesday's big day. But there's more than that. It's more than just the wearing of the green to consider on these days in the cities. So just ask Visit Quad Cities, because here's a list of events coming up.
Check out the things to do this week in the Quad Cities. The Last Picture House is hosting a video games tournament that'll be fun for everyone. Come cheer on everyone who's competing. Next, head to Oak Grove Tavern, grab a mic, pick your favorite song, and sing your heart out during karaoke. Then, stop by Gathering of the Green, a nationwide conference for antique John Deere collectors, restorers, and enthusiasts. Next, get ready for line dancing at the Mississippi Valley Fairgrounds. There will be food and drink available as well. Finally, Larry the Cable Guy is making his way to the Rhythm City Casino Resort Event Center. Get your tickets today. For more events like these, check out our events calendar at visitquadcities.com.
We like to take the time to showcase musical talent in the cities, and that brings us to Daniel Stratman. He has Southern California roots, but he considers himself a troubadour with an average Joe persona. So here's Daniel Stratman with Satisfied.
The melody always comes first, and if I'm lucky, I come up with a couple of scratch lyrics, and if it's worth writing down, I always have paper and tablets around, and I start writing down the melody line and maybe a few lyrics. We had a night that I will never forget. You stole my heart and swept me away. Tomorrow hasn't even happened yet. There's nothing more that I want to say. I'm satisfied. Mm-hmm. I'm satisfied. Mm-hmm. Well, I've been out walking on these city streets, following the neon lights. There's somewhere you'd like to go where we could meet. Anywhere, wherever you like. I'm satisfied. Mm-hmm. I'm satisfied. Mm-hmm. Now I can't seem to get you out of my head. Watching your every move, and I'm hanging on to every word you said. You inspire me, oh yes you do. The first song is called Satisfied, and it just means those moments in life where you're actually happy. You know, you're kind of satiated. It could be a dinner out with a friend. It could be a moment that you have with the one that you love. It could just be a quiet Sunday morning where the sun's coming through the window, and you just have those little quick moments where just like everything's okay. Right now, everything's good.
Yes, I will. Mother Nature's humming along. I'm satisfied.
I'm satisfied. I had a friend of mine that told me years and years ago, he said, Daniel, you're driven. And there's just something, you know, I think we all have a passion. We all have a reason for living. And, you know, what gets us out of bed in the morning that makes us jump. And, you know, I get the biggest bang out of just getting out and not just writing songs, because that's a very difficult process, even though it's a gift. But getting out and playing in front of public is the most rewarding thing I've ever done. And it just, there's nothing like it.
I'm satisfied. Satisfied.
Daniel Stratman with Satisfied. He released a new CD last year called Painters and Poets, and it is streaming at danielstratman.com. 250 years ago, it took a spark to create a nation. As America marks the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, we look at what spark people in the Quad Cities have that has helped them make our area a better place to live. QC Air is an organization that tries to help refugees and migrants assimilate into life in America, something our founding fathers knew a thing or two about. We asked its executive director, Amy DeHaven, what led her to be a part of this effort? What is her civic spark?
QC Air, we are not a religious organization. For me, I am a follower of Jesus. He is my Lord and Savior, and he tells us that we are to fight and be the voice for the voiceless. And that is what my driving desire is. There are people in the world that need help and don't have the voice to do that. I've worked with people with disabilities, and various degrees, and I have a servant heart. I really feel that it's my responsibility to help those that are vulnerable and need help, and anything that I can do to service them and help them feel a little bit more comfortable is what drives me.
Our thanks to QC Air Executive Director Amy DeHaven. On the air, on the radio, on the web, on your mobile device, and streaming on your computer. Thanks for taking some time to join us as we talk about the issues on the cities.